Would open your Bibles up to Psalm 86. I see everyone fanning themselves. I know it is a little bit warmer in here. Psalm 86, verses 1 through 17, as we continue our series through the summer Psalms, we'll look at verses 1 through 17, the entirety of Psalm 86 this morning. So when my kids were younger, not as much now, but when they were younger, anytime I was trying to do something around the house, generally they would want to help. That changes as they get older. More often than not, though, I loved having them involved and being a part of what it was that I was doing. But in many cases, having them help was not necessarily for my sake, but for theirs. Whether it was putting together a piece of furniture or taking the training wheels off of a bike, typically, like most children, they would want to help. Now, did I need their help? Probably not. I probably could have figured it out. Did I want their help? Yes, because I wanted to spend time with them and wanted them involved in the activities of my own life. The same was true as I was growing up. Anytime I'd visit with my dad, he would always have a car to work on, and I don't have the faintest clue about what to do when it comes to cars, but I knew that every time I would see him, we would be working on something that had to do with a car. It wasn't as though I was necessarily offering advice or doing something he could not do, but no, he wanted me to help and wanted me involved. At various points in our lives, we've been involved as perhaps a helper to someone else, or we've asked someone else to fill that role in our own lives. But when we think about that word helper, when we come to the writers of the scriptures, and when we see that God is our helper, they mean something completely different than what we typically think of a helper to be. So consider how this idea is used in the scriptures, for example. Psalm 54, verse 4. Here, the psalmist says, God is my helper. The Lord is the upholder of my life. Or we'll see this next week in the Psalm 121. Here, the psalmist says, I lift my eyes up to the hills. From where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord. Or Hebrews 13, verse 6, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? Surely the idea here is more than just the Lord is going to be involved in my life and he's going to help me along with the daily things that I'm going to do myself. No, there's an assertion here that without the help of the Lord, there is no tomorrow. Without his help, that situation does not turn out well for me. We don't view the Lord as our helper, perhaps as we would view one of our kids coming alongside of us and just tacking on things that we would do ourselves. No, without the Lord and his help, we have no hope. So when the writers of the scriptures call the Lord their helper, that is what they mean. Not, the Lord's going to help me along and make my day a bit better. But no, if I don't have the Lord, I don't live. I need God or I'm overtaken. I need what the Lord can do for me or I don't make it. And that's what we see here this morning in Psalm 86 from King David. For here we see that in whatever the circumstance might be, whether in life or in death, that we too can have a helper. So if you will look at Psalm 86 with me, again, we'll look at verses 1 through 17 as we look at the entirety of this psalm this morning. Psalm 86, beginning in verse 1. Incline your ear, O Lord, and answer me, for I am poor and needy. Preserve my life, for I am godly. Save your servant who trusts in you. You are my God. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for to you do I cry all the day. Gladden the soul of your servant, for to you, O Lord, do I lift up my soul. For you, O Lord, are good and forgiving, abounding in steadfast love to all who call upon you. Give ear, O Lord, to my prayer. Listen to my plea for grace. In the day of my trouble, I call upon you, for you answer me. There is none like you among the gods, O Lord, nor are there any works like yours. All the nations you have made shall come and worship before you, O Lord, and shall glorify your name. For you are great and do wondrous things. You alone are God. Teach me your way, O Lord, that I may walk in your truth. Unite my heart to fear your name. I give thanks to you, O Lord my God, with my whole heart, and I will glorify your name forever. For great is your steadfast love toward me. You have delivered my soul from the depths of Sheol. O God, insolent men have risen up against me. A band of ruthless men seek my life, and they do not set you before them. But you, O Lord, are a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Turn to me and be gracious to me. Give your strength to your servant and save the son of your maidservant. Show me a sign of your favor that those who hate me may see and be put to shame because you, Lord, have helped me and comforted me. So King David had many instances in his life where he was opposed. Perhaps you can think of some of them as you think of King David and know bits and pieces about his life. You think of his wife, Michal, in 2 Samuel chapter 6. Remember this, David is dancing in the streets as he brings the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem and he's praising the Lord. The presence of God has come. And what does his wife do? She's looking out of a window, mocking him and telling him as she sees him, how foolish you look. You think of a man named Shimei who mocked David as he was fleeing Jerusalem. 2 Samuel chapter 16, when he's running from his son Absalom, Shimei's looking at him and yells out, "You murderer, you scoundrel." Perhaps you remember this one, David and Goliath, 1 Samuel chapter 17. Remember what Goliath says as David approaches him? He mocks him over his size and over his apparent weakness. That obviously did not go well for Goliath. But none of those mockings will compare to the two times where David had to escape and flee for his life. The first one, before he even became king, as he's on the run from King Saul. And then the second one, as he's on the run from his son Absalom. Now, with Saul, you have a clear element of jealousy that's present. If you remember this, we went through 1 and 2 Samuel a couple years ago. Saul knew that David was to be the next king, and that God's presence had left him due to his own disobedience and would be placed and was placed upon David. Now, sure, there was a lot of fear on David's end, a lot of uncertainty during this time, confusion and loneliness, but the Lord preserved him with a band of 400 men and many others who were to be set and to help set him over the kingdom of Israel when his time would come. But I would argue further that there is nothing in David's life, I believe, that would rival what he went through when he was on the run from his son. We heard a bit about this situation in some of the other Psalms that we've looked at so far this summer. But to have your own son come in and try to seek your throne, to want to put you to death, to exile you outside of the kingdom, yes, that's huge, but that's only one part of what David would have dealt with. You also have to consider the inner turmoil that was going on in David's heart that he didn't deal with necessarily with Saul, knowing that his actions with Bathsheba in 2 Samuel 11 and 12 were what was leading to the tearing of his family apart. So to deal with the memory of your own sin, the particular sin of adultery and murder, and then have this situation where you're fleeing from your own son, but then perhaps all of that to go together to think that it's his fault as to why he even has to flee to begin with. Again, we don't know exactly the period of David's life as to when the psalm was written, but I tend to believe as we read through the psalm here, Psalm 86, as you listen to it, as you hear the references to who God is and the experiences that the writer had with God and the references to other psalms that have already been written, I tend to believe that David is writing this from a place of fleeing from his son Absalom once again as he's alone in the wilderness. For it's here that he knows that he has no one. And it's here that David sees that the safety from his enemies and safety in his circumstances and in this period of his life is all but a mirage and is not guaranteed to him in his own strength. Now, why would I say that? Why would I say that safety in the mind of David is a mirage here in Psalm 86? Well, the reality is that there is no such thing as safety, no matter what our situation is. There's no such thing as risk-free when it comes to the world around us. There's no such thing as to having everything under our control. And this is and will always be the case for us as long as we're here on this earth. And that is simply because we don't know what will happen next year or next month or tomorrow or in 30 seconds. Whether we're David on the run or whether we're approaching the circumstances of tomorrow. And since all of that is true, that means that we need a helper. So as we consider what that means then, as we call God our helper, Let's first look at verses 1 through 7 as we see the God who hears. So as in some of the previous Psalms we've looked at over the last few weeks, again, we don't know the exact situation of the writer, although again, we can speculate as we've done here this morning. We don't know exactly what prompted David to write what he did. What we do know is the attitude of which he wrote it. And we could see that based upon not some special insight into his mind or through some piecing together of some sort of secret evidence, but through the words that are written right before us. So look at verse 1 again, if you will. Incline your ear, O Lord, and answer me. Come down to me, for I am lowly. You are exalted, and I am beneath you. What does this picture conjure up for you in your own mind? It's a picture, what, of a child reaching up to their father, isn't it? Pick me up, bend down, and listen to me. Why? For I am poor and needy. Now, this can only come from someone who has been humbled, right? For someone who is proud, they don't ask anyone, including the Lord, to bend down and to help them. But not only is this prayer from a humble heart, but it's from a confident heart. So the same child who lifts up his arms to his father, asking him to pick him up, is the same child that actually believes his father will pick him up. Therefore, humility doesn't mean that you don't believe anyone can help, but instead it means that you believe that you actually need help, and you put that together with the confidence that David shows here, and you have a man who cries out to the Lord, believing him to be in need, and God being the only one who can meet that need. Listen to what Charles Spurgeon says about the humility and confidence together that are displayed here. He says, "When our prayers are lowly by reason of our humility or feeble by reason of our sickness, the Lord will bow down to them. The infinitely exalted Jehovah will have respect unto them." What a concept this is. And the created one who is in need, reaching and calling upon the Creator. The weak one calling out to the one who is strong. The lowly one calling out upon the one who is exalted. And then the exalted one stooping down to hear. I remember watching a clip, this is several years ago now, Prince William stooping down to tell his son something and listen back to him. They were in a public scenario on a balcony. They were with the queen at this point. But the second that Prince William stooped down to tell his son something, his grandmother, then the queen, immediately told him to stand back up. Now, why would she have done this? He was just talking to his son. Well, the reason why is because kings don't stoop down. It's beneath them. They're royal, they're exalted, they're majestic. That's why verse 1 is so amazing here. We have a God who we can cry out to and who will come down to us and who will hear us. If you are here and you feel as though God has better things to worry about, or that your problem is not significant enough to bring before him, or even if you feel the Lord is not listening, call upon him because he hears you and he will answer. What a tragedy it is to have a God who is waiting and willing to listen and respond, but then you don't seek after him. It's almost like an infant who won't cry out, even though his parents are right next to him. Russell Moore, in his book titled Adopted for Life, tells a story of he and his wife picking up their sons from a Russian orphanage. As a couple, at least at this point in their life, they had struggled to have children, leading the Lord to place upon their hearts to adopt and to adopt internationally. Well, listen to this part where he talks about meeting the two boys for the first time and about the cries that they gave during this visit. It's a little bit of a lengthy excerpt, but it illustrates the point that I think our psalmist is getting at here perfectly. He says this, "The creepiest sound I have ever heard was nothing at all. My wife, Maria, and I stood in the hallway of an orphanage somewhere in the former Soviet Union on the first of two trips required for our petition to adopt. Orphanage staff led us down a hallway to greet the 2 1-year-olds we hoped would become our sons. The horror wasn't the squalor and the stench, although at times we had to stifle the urge to want to vomit and weep. The horror was the quiet of it all. The place was more silent than a funeral home by night. I stopped and I pulled on Maria's elbow and I said, "Why is it so quiet here? This place is filled with babies." Both of us compared the stillness with the buzz of the squeals that we would often hear back home from our church nursery. Here, if we listened carefully enough, we could hear babies rocking themselves back and forth, the crib slats gently bumping against the walls. These children did not cry because infants eventually learn to stop crying if no one ever responds to their calls for food or for comfort or for love. No one ever responded to these children, so they stopped. The silence continued as we entered the boys' room. Little Sergi, now Timothy, smiled at us, dancing up and down while holding the side of his crib. Little Maxim, who is now Benjamin, stood straight at attention, regal and czar-like. But neither boy made a sound. We read them books filled with words they couldn't understand about saying goodnight to the moon and cows jumping over that same moon. But there were no squeals, no cries, no groans. Every day we left at the appointed time in the same way we had entered, in silence. Well, on the last day of the trip, Maria and I arrived at the moment we had dreaded since the minute that we had received our adoption referral. We had to tell the boys goodbye, as by law, we had to return to the United States and wait for legal paperwork to be completed before we came back to pick them up for good. So after hugging and kissing them, we walked out of the quiet hallway as my wife Maria shook with tears, and that is when we finally heard the scream. Little Maxim fell back in his crib and let out a yell. It seemed he knew maybe for the first time that he would actually be heard. On some primal level, he knew he had a father and a mother now. I will never forget how the hairs on my arms stood up as I heard the yell. I was struck maybe for the first time by the force of the Abba cry passages in the New Testament. And I was surprised by how little I had gotten them until actually now. Little Maxim's scream changed everything, more, I think, than did the judge's verdict and the notarized paperwork. It was the moment in his recognizing that he would be heard, that he went from being an orphan to being a son. It was also the moment I had became a father, in fact, if not by law. We both recognized that something was wrong, but came suddenly, because suddenly life, as it had been seemed, was terribly disordered. On our right, we have no right to call out to God, no confidence that he'll hear us, no guarantee that he will answer. For by our own nature, we are separated from God because of our sin. But Jesus, the perfect one, the righteous one, he lived the life that we could not live. He died in our place and bridged the gap of separation between us and God. He satisfies that debt, overcomes our sin, defeats the curse. And now because of him, verse 2, all who trust in him are no longer orphans. So if you're here today and you're not a Christian, forsake your current way of life and trust in Jesus as the only way. And with the rest of us, become a son and a daughter. For to us as sons and daughters through Christ, verse 5, the Lord is now only good and forgiving. To us now, the Lord is only abounding in steadfast love. Don't remain silent. Call out to him, for he will answer. Secondly, because of God's character, we can rest assured that when we call out to God, he will act. From beginning to end, the Bible gives us a picture of the greatness of God. Yes, the storyline of the scriptures fixes on our redemption from sin through our Savior Jesus Christ, but underlying that theme is the greatness and the majesty of a God who continually shows himself to be bigger and better than any other God we could ever create in our own mind here in this world. For again, as Charles Spurgeon says, "What have the false gods ever made or unmade? What miracles have they wrought? When did they divide a sea or march through the wilderness scattering bread from the skies?" They don't work like our God. Our God is the one who made the heavens and the earth, if that were not enough. But even more than that, he is the one who flooded the earth full of sin, rescuing one man and his family. He is the one who, as we read earlier in Exodus 15, parted the Red Sea and drowned all of his enemies. He is the one who the Philistines, when they captured the ark, remember this 1 Samuel 5? The ark was captured and put into the temple of Dagon. They find Dagon bowed down to the ark the next day. He is the one who when it looked as though all hope was gone, put to shame the prophets of Baal at the cry of his prophet Elijah. He is the one who sent his son ultimately to die on our behalf so that we might be rescued from our sin. For as William Plummer says, all false gods are either dead things or dead men or lost angels, but Jehovah is the living God. They can neither see nor hear, nor help nor save, but our God does all things after the counsel of his will. Look here specifically at verse 10 for just a second. David says, for you are great and do wondrous things. You alone are God. That for there, that clues us into something. Because that for is the reason for what is stated here. So verse 8, there is none like you among the gods, O Lord, nor are there any works like yours. For you are great and do wondrous things. Or verse 9, all the nations you have made shall come and worship before you, O Lord, and shall glorify your name. For you are great and do wondrous things. Do you see that? That's the clause that supports why he can say that. For you are great and have done wondrous things. Now, here's why that's significant. If I were to say to you, yesterday I went out and I bought a new car. I didn't do that. But let's say I did that. You might say, well, why did you do that? What was wrong with the one you had? That doesn't sound like a very good decision. But if I said I bought this car because my old car broke down and could not be fixed, well, that enlightens the situation a bit more as to why I would say what I said to begin with. That gives explanation for the action that occurred. O Lord, verse 9, the nations you have made will come and worship before you and glorify your name. Why? Well, for or because you are great and do wondrous things. So what David is doing here is he's presenting a big picture of who God is to us. He is not a God who is just a God that we here at our church worship. He's not a God of whom just we alone follow in this book, the Bible, and we tell others to follow about. Nor is he a God that our Western culture has made up or some mythical being that we're simply passing down legends and stories about. No, this is a big God who has displayed himself throughout all of history, and all the nations will one day stream into his presence through Jesus Christ. And they will bring worship to him forever and ever. Therefore, verse 11, in light of all that truth, David says, teach me your ways, O Lord. Give me this grand vision of your greatness that I may walk in your truth. Now this psalm gets a bit personal, doesn't it? O Lord, teach me your greatness, for I am often divided in my thoughts. I often worry or become anxious or doubt and fear. So Lord, since I have a tendency to diverge over to these thoughts and anxiety and fear and worry, instead teach me your ways, so that I may walk in the truth of who you are. You ever thought about that in the midst of your anxiety or worry or fear? That the simple solution at times, and I'm not denying deeper thoughts and things going on, but the simple solution at times can be to fix your heart upon the truth of God and his ways. David is confident in verse 13 that God has delivered his soul from death. In other words, there seems to be this confidence that at the end of his life, he will be with God. He knows that. But yet the situations of his life, they still torment him as they're doing right now. So therefore, teach me your way, O Lord, so that I may know of and remember your greatness. Many of you could easily attest to the fact that God has saved you through Christ. Perhaps you would confess that clearly in any and every circumstance, knowing that when this life is done, that you will be with God because of what Christ has done. But what David is asking for here is perhaps a prayer you need to pray at times. Asking God to teach you his ways, to show you his greatness through the pages of the scriptures, to point out to you his faithfulness in the midst of your own life from the past and right now, even in the present. And to remind you of all that he's done and show you his great steadfast love towards you. So that today, presently, you may walk in his truth. Now, why is all that so important? Why is it so important that God act to remind you and to show you of his great and wondrous works towards you? Well, we see this because thirdly, not only does God hear and God act, but God also transcends. So Greg Boyd, in his book titled The God of the Possible, describes a circumstance in which a lady who was in his church, of whom he was counseling with, recently dealt with her husband committing adultery with another woman and then leaving her for that woman. The situation completely devastated her, and it should. She couldn't see how in any way a good God would let her go through something that in her own mind was so horrific. Some of her friends told her that perhaps that she didn't pray hard enough through the situation. Some other friends said, maybe you misread the will of God before you got married. Maybe you shouldn't have married him to begin with. All unhelpful advice, perhaps like Job's friends offered to him. Well, she was not satisfied with these answers, and so she went to her pastor, Greg Boyd, and here's what he said to her. He said, God feels as much regret over the situation as you do. He truly believed and hoped that this would turn out to be a good and happy marriage. But because your ex-husband is a free agent, even the decisions he made have those results apart from God. God tried to restore him, but your ex-husband had changed and was different than the man that God told you to marry. Boyd says, looking back on his counsel, that this woman now did not have to be confused over whether or not she rightly heard from God. She could know that even God still loved her and still cared for her and wants what is best for her, but that her husband was free to make his own decisions, and that was all apart from the knowledge of God. Now, I hope that pricks at something in your own mind when you hear that, of something that's wrong. I hope that you're not saying there, yeah, that's good. No, here's what's wrong with that. I don't know about you, but that answer is not the answer I want to receive in time of need. I don't want someone to come to me and say, God did not know that was going to happen. God cannot do anything about your situation. He's right there alongside of you, hoping that things turn out better just like you do. That is not the counsel you want to receive in your time of need. In a time when you're uncertain about the future, or in this case, in this example here, a time when you don't know what's going to happen with the marriage, as with this woman, or with perhaps in your own life, if your child will ever change, or you'll ever find a job again, or things will ever get back to normal, perhaps whatever's going on in your life, you don't want to hear, well, God is trying his best and he's working real hard right now. No, that vision of God is too small. You don't want a God who simply sympathizes with you. You want a God who transcends you. You want to remember verse 8, that there is none among the gods like you, O Lord. You want to walk in the truth of a God who knows the end from the beginning, who orchestrates all things, good and bad, by the power of his hand. And indeed will, as Romans 8 says, work all things, being your job, your family, your situation, your fears, your uncertainties, your depressions. He will work it all out if you are in Christ for your good and for his glory. Look at the situation here that David brings up in prayer. He says in verse 14, "Oh God, insolent men have risen up against me." David doesn't want to hear a response back by God saying, "I see that now too. A band of ruthless men seeks my life. They do not set you before them." Now remember how I said that we don't know exactly the situation that prompted David to write this. We could say that perhaps it's with Saul chasing him, or David's in caves. Or again, I think more accurately would be his son Absalom chasing after him with the armies that were in the past loyal to David, but perhaps not loyal to him now. But either way, we get a picture that his life is in danger, and it's not just a few men, but many men who are seeking after his life. But you know what? David did not have to fear men. Why? Because the God that he served was bigger than his problem, was bigger than his circumstance and his fear and his uncertainty. For the God that he serves, the God that we serve, is beyond time, beyond our plans, and beyond the plots of others. That's what I mean when I say that our God transcends. He is outside of this world, yet, let's not just leave him transcendent, yet he is in control and active in every part in our life. There's a book out there titled When People Are Big and God Is Small, and the basic premise of it says that we typically tend to view people, or we can expand it out, and we view our circumstances as if it's too big for God. Meaning that we tend to listen to and fear what is going on in our own lives more than we tend to listen to and fear the Lord. But this is where verse 11 becomes so important to us. This is where we must know the Lord and his character. This is where we must remember his faithfulness to us. This is where we must study his promises and trust that he can and will fulfill them and see him as greater than any other circumstance in our lives. In fact, let me encourage you to memorize verse 11 this week. And as you memorize it, don't just repeat it, but pray it back to the Lord. When you wake up or when you sit down for lunch or mid-afternoon or dinner time before you go to bed or whatever it might be this week, pray to the Lord and ask him to teach you his ways. Oh Lord, that I may walk in your truth, unite my heart to fear your name. Ask the Lord to remind you of times in his word and even in your own lives when he did hear you, when he did act, and how he transcended your situation. And pray to him, teach me your ways, O Lord, that I may walk in your truth, unite my heart to fear your name. And then believe he will as you seek him through his word. This verse was so crucial for David here. Because as he was being hunted down, whether by Saul or Absalom or another enemy, perhaps, if he didn't know the character of God or believe the truth of who God was or is, then his circumstance would have overtaken him, leading him to despair of his own life, grow weary, perhaps even give up. But he didn't. And we know this by his response in verse 15. But you, O Lord, are a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. So are you down today, perhaps? Confused? Anxious, worried, fearful? Maybe not. Maybe you're calm right now. But at some point in your life, you'll experience circumstances that will lead you to want to give up or to be afraid as to what is to come. Either way, don't remain silent like an orphan child who's not heard, for God hears. Trust in the character of God, for God acts. And let your hope in God's steadfast love, which has been shown to you if you are in Christ, drive you to crying out to him in prayer, just as a son or a daughter cries out to their father at times in need, for God transcends. We have a helper. Not one who wants to come alongside of us and be involved in our lives and help us with our day-to-day activities, but one through Christ who can save us from our sin and one who will be present with us in the midst of your life today. Call out to that helper. Trust in his character and rest that he is in control and can and will work in your life in response to your prayers, believing, verse 4, that he will gladden your soul with his presence in your life. Amen. Let's pray.